1905 to 1997, notes that God describes the promised land in different terms when speaking to the patriarchs than to the Israelites. When Abraham was promised the land of Canaan, he was not told anything about its beauty and riches, because he did not need evidence of the greatness of God's promise. Genesis chapter 12, verse 1. However, the Israelites, who were more skeptical, not to mention more theologically primitive, were promised a land flowing with milk and honey. Given the depth of Moses' faith, the patriarchal description of Canaan now offered, the one without any mention of the land's beauty or riches, is sufficient for Moses. Verse 5. I have now heard the moaning of the Israelites because the Egyptians are holding them in bondage, and I have remembered my covenant. God tells Moses he can be fully trusted to deliver the Israelites from slavery, because he remembers the promise he made to the patriarchs. When God remembers, it is the Torah's way of saying God has decided to act at that moment. Verse 6. Say therefore to the Israelite people, I am the Lord. I will free you from the labors of the Egyptians and deliver you from their bondage. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and through extraordinary chastisements. This verse is the traditional reason why Jews drink 4 cups of wine at the Passover Seder. Each cup represents the 3 divine promises in this verse, and the divine promise in the following verse. I will free you, I will deliver you, I will redeem you, I will take you to be my people. There are actually 3 more promises in the following 2 verses. Then again, 4 cups of wine is quite sufficient. I will be your God. I will bring you into the land. I will give it to you for a possession. Why 7 is the most important number in the Torah? God thus makes a total of 7 promises. Once again, the number 7 appears in the Torah. It is the most significant and recurring number in the Torah. To cite only some examples, the world is created in 7 days. The Sabbath is on the 7th day. Every 7th year is a sabbatical year for the land, Leviticus chapter 25, verses 3 through 6. And every Jubilee year, Leviticus chapter 25, verses 8 through 12, begins after every 49th year, 7 times 7. The festivals of Pesach, Passover, and Sukkot tabernacles are each 7 days long. The reason, of course, is the number 7 signifies God is the creator. This greater significance of 7, representing God's creation of the world in 7 days, argues for my belief that the first verse of the Torah, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, is the most important verse in the Bible. Even that verse, in the Hebrew, contains 7 words. In brief, the reason that verse and the recurring number 7 is so important is that everything in the Torah and the Bible rests on the belief God is the creator. If one does not accept that, the God of the Bible is a fairy tale, and all life is just a natural coincidence devoid of ultimate meaning. Verse 7, And I will take you to be my people, and I will be your God. The language of this verse, and I will take you to be my people, is reminiscent of the language of the ancient Jewish marriage contract, Ketubah, in which a man takes a woman for his wife and the woman accepts his proposal. This husband-wife metaphor is commonly used throughout the literature of the prophets to describe the relationship between God and Israel. Most famously, the prophet Hosea speaks of God speaking to the Jewish people, I will betroth you unto me forever. I will betroth you unto me with righteousness and justice, and with goodness and mercy. And I will betroth you unto me with faithfulness, and you shall know God. Hosea chapter 2, verse 21. Again, the number 7 is alluded to by the 7 statements of betrothal in Hosea's verse. To this day, in the Jewish wedding ceremony, 7 blessings are recited under the wedding canopy, and those 7 blessings are repeated daily on the 7 days following the wedding. In this verse, God is also telling the Jewish people they are a nation only insofar as God is their God. Many secular Jews have made significant contributions to modern Jewish history. It was largely secular Jews, for example, who founded the modern state of Israel. But secular Jews who wish to perpetuate a secular Jewish identity have rarely been successful. Their descendants either come to embrace some form of God-centered Judaism, or ultimately cease identifying as Jews. Verse 7 continued, "And you shall know that I, the Lord, am your God who freed you from the labors of the Egyptians." Verse 8, "I will bring you into the land which I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I will give it to you for a possession, I, the Lord." Verse 9, "But when Moses told this to the Israelites, they would not listen to Moses, their spirits crushed by cruel bondage." Verse 10, "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying," verse 11, "Go and tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to let the Israelites depart from his land." God no longer tells Moses to speak to Pharaoh politely, or to request permission for the Israelites to sacrifice to God for about a week. Verse 12, "But Moses appealed to the Lord, saying, 'The Israelites would not listen to me. How then should Pharaoh heed me, a man of impeded speech?' Moses raises three objections. The Israelites will not listen to him, Pharaoh will not listen to him, and he does not speak well. Verse 13, "So the Lord spoke to both Moses and Aaron in regard to the Israelites and Pharaoh king of Egypt, instructing them to deliver the Israelites from the land of Egypt." This time, God speaks to Aaron as well. Verse 14, "The following are the heads of their respective clans. The sons of Reuben, Israel's firstborn. Enoch and Pallu, Hetzron and Carmi, those who are the families of Reuben. Verse 15, the sons of Simeon, Yemuel, Yamin, Ohad, Yachin, Zohar, and Saul, the son of a Canaanite woman. These are the families of Simeon. Verse 16, "These are the names of Levi's sons by their lineage, Gershon, Kehat, and Merari." And the span of Levi's life was 137 years. Verse 17, "The sons of Gershon, Libni and Shimei by their families." Verse 18, "The sons of Kehat, Amram, Izhar, Hebron, and Uzziel." And the span of Kehat's life was 133 years. Verse 19, "The sons of Merari, Mahli and Mushi." These are the families of the Levites by their lineage. Verses 14 to 19 present the family background of Moses through his father Amram. I believe it gives the Torah historical credibility. Verse 20. Amram took to wife his father's sister Jochebed, and she bore him Aaron and Moses, and the span of Amram's life was 137 years. Torah law forbids a man from marrying his aunt, Leviticus chapter 18, verses 12 through 13. But obviously such a law was not applicable before the Torah. Though Amram's daughter Miriam, Moses' older sister, plays a prominent role in the Torah, her birth is not recorded here, only the birth of sons, as was the norm in societies throughout much of history. Nevertheless, Miriam is regularly designated by name in the Torah, and is even regarded as a prophet. See, for example, Exodus chapter 2, verses 4 through 9, and 15, chapter 20 through 21. Verse 21, the sons of Itzar, Korah, Nepheg, and Zikri. Verse 22, the sons of Uzziel, Mishael, Elzaphan, and Zithri. Essay, Prominent Parents and Their Children. Verse 23, Aaron took to wife Elishiva, daughter of Abinadav and sister of Nashon, and she bore him Nadav and Avihu, Eleazar and Itamar. Aaron's sons are mentioned, but not Moses's. The lack of attention to Moses' son here and elsewhere in the Torah, essentially nothing is said about them, needs to be explained. And the explanation is probably this: they did not amount to much. This raises the interesting issue of the difficulty many children of great people face in leading successful and satisfying lives. In a book about Moses, Overcoming Life's Disappointments, Rabbi Harold Kushner writes about this. Sometimes the father casts so large a shadow that he makes it hard for his children to find the sunshine they need to grow and flourish. Sometimes the father's achievements are so intimidating that the child just gives up any hope of equaling him, But mostly, I suspect, it takes so much of a man's, the father's, time and energy to be a great man, great in some ways but not in all, that he has too little time left to be a father. As the South African leader Nelson Mandela's daughter was quoted as saying to him, "You are the father of all our people, but you never had time to be a father to me." Kushner relates a remarkable story he read in a magazine geared toward clergy, a fictional account of a pastor in a mid-sized church who had a dream one night in which a voice said to him, "There are 50 teenagers in your church, and you have the ability to lead 49 of them to God and lose out on only one." Energized by the dream, the minister throws all his energy into youth work, organizing special classes and trips for the church's teens. He eventually develops a national reputation in his denomination for his work with young people. And then one night he discovers his 16-year-old son has been arrested for dealing drugs. The boy turned bitterly against the church and its teachings, resenting his father for having had time for every 16-year-old in town except him, and the father never noticed. His son was the 50th teenager, the one who got away. Of course, this was not necessarily true of Moses' children, but the silence of the Torah concerning his children, which is not the case with the children of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Aaron, serves as an important reminder to parents who have achieved success to be sure to make time for their children. They need to try to ensure their children feel they occupy a special place in their parents' hearts. And no matter how pressing the parent's responsibilities, he or she will always find time for them. Verse 24. The sons of Korah, Asir, Elkanah, and Ahiasaph. Those are the families of the Korahites. Verse 25. And Aaron's son Eleazar took to wife one of Putiel's daughters, and she bore him Phinehas. Those are the heads of the fathers' houses of the Levites by their families. Verse 26. It is the same Aaron and Moses to whom the Lord said, "Bring forth the Israelites from the land of Egypt, troop by troop." The Torah uses a military expression to highlight the force with which God will deliver the Israelites from Egyptian bondage. Verse 27. It was they who spoke to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to free the Israelites from the Egyptians. These are the same, Moses and Aaron. Verse 28. For when the Lord spoke to Moses in the land of Egypt, verse 29, and the Lord said to Moses, "I am the Lord, speak to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all that I will tell you." Verse 30, Moses appealed to the Lord, saying, "See, I am of impeded speech. How then should Pharaoh heed me?" Regarding Moses' issues of speech and public speaking, see the commentary to Exodus chapter 4, verses 10 through 12. Chapter 7, verse 1. The Lord replied to Moses, "See, I place you in the role of God to Pharaoh." Moses will have such command over Pharaoh, he will in effect be playing the role of God in Pharaoh's life. This is particularly significant because Pharaoh sees himself and his people see him as a god. Verse 1 continued, "with your brother Aaron as your prophet." The Hebrew word Navi is commonly translated as prophet, but it actually means spokesman. The primary role of Aaron and of the later prophets in the Hebrew Bible, such as Amos, Isaiah, and Jeremiah, is not to predict the future, but to serve as God's spokesman or spokeswoman. Aaron has precisely that role, to convey God's words to Pharaoh as they are transmitted to Moses. Verse 2. "You shall repeat all that I command you, and your brother Aaron shall speak to Pharaoh to let the Israelites depart from his land." Verse 3. "But I will harden Pharaoh's heart, that I may multiply my signs and marvels in the land of Egypt." Once again, God reassures Moses that he should not grow dismayed when Pharaoh refuses to release the Israelites, because God will have strengthened Pharaoh's heart. Moses, therefore, should not feel that had he delivered his message more effectively, Pharaoh might have released the Israelites. The plagues had three major purposes. Verse 4. "When Pharaoh does not heed you, I will lay my hand upon Egypt and deliver my ranks, my people, the Israelites, from the land of Egypt with extraordinary chastisements." There are three major purposes for the 10 plagues. The first and most obvious is to force Pharaoh and the Egyptians to release the Hebrews. The second is to punish Pharaoh and the Egyptians for the terrible suffering they inflicted on the Israelites over hundreds of years, including, for a time, the mass murder of newborn Hebrew boys. God and the Torah believe in punishment when appropriate, because God and the Torah are preoccupied with justice. Thank God. While the world needs compassion and other good traits, they must all be rooted in justice, or we end up with neither justice nor compassion. The third purpose of the plagues is to demonstrate to the Israelites and to the Egyptians that God, not the gods of Egypt, including Pharaoh, is the real God. That is why, as we shall see, the plagues were specifically directed against Egypt's gods. Essay. Is there such a thing as collective guilt? The punishments inflicted on Egypt raise the difficult issue of what is known as collective guilt. Specifically, was it right to punish the Egyptian people for decisions made by their pharaoh? I will address the unique moral problem of the 10th plague, God's killing of the firstborn throughout Egypt, in the commentary on that plague. The Torah's answer is yes, because the evils inflicted by the Egyptians on the Hebrews were not inflicted by a few individuals, but by the Egyptian people, though presumably not by every single Egyptian, over the course of centuries. The Torah made the collective nature of Egyptian participation in the enslavement, torment, and murder of Israelites clear in the first chapter of Exodus, verse 22. The Torah also makes it clear when it comes to individual crimes, as opposed to national crimes, evil is to be punished only on an individual level. Thus, if a member of a family or clan murders a member of another family or clan, it is expressly forbidden to punish the murderer's family or clan. That is one of the great moral advances inherent in the much misunderstood Torah law of an eye for an eye, a life for a life. Every punishment must be equivalent to the crime, not more, and must only be inflicted on the perpetrator, not his family. Except for capital punishment for murderers, the other punishments are all financial, not physical. See the commentary to Exodus chapter 21, verses 24 through 25. But when it comes to mass evil committed by a nation, there can indeed be collective guilt. We cannot deny national evil just because not every member of a nation was guilty. Take slavery in America. The whole American nation paid a terrible price, as the whole Egyptian nation did, because of the national crime of African slavery. America fought its civil war because of slavery, a war in which as many Americans died as in all the other American wars combined, a list that includes World Wars I and II, the Korean War, and the Vietnamese War, over 700,000, a statistic particularly striking given America's population in 1860 was only 31 million. Of course, as in all wars, many of those most deserving of punishment, such as in the case of American slavery, the slave kidnappers and traitors, often get away with their crimes. In fact, according to the Torah, Exodus chapter 21, verse 16, those individuals deserved the death penalty. At the same time, many innocents suffered, and many died. The only perfect justice is in the world to come. Statements on slavery by two of America's greatest presidents affirm the notion of collective guilt. Thomas Jefferson, the third American president and the author of America's Declaration of Independence, warned that Americans will one day collectively pay for the sin of slavery. I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever. During the American Civil War, Abraham Lincoln, too, affirmed America's collective guilt for slavery. Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet, if God wills that it continue until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, so it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. Psalm 19, verse 10. To deny this, Lincoln told friends a week later, is to deny that there is a God governing the world. Lincoln knew his Bible. While he did not regularly attend church, he constantly studied the scriptures. As he put it, "In regard to this great book, I have but to say it is the best gift God has given to man. But for it, we could not know right from wrong." Slavery was a universally practiced evil. But the crimes of Germany during World War II, such as the bombing of civilian centers in England, Poland, Russia, and elsewhere, and the carefully engineered annihilation of two-thirds of Europe's Jews and millions of other innocents, the Holocaust, were unique. And given the knowledge and or active support of most Germans for Hitler's invasions of countries and bombings of civilian centers, and given the active or tacit support for slave labor and for mass deportations of Jews and others, even if not every German knew nearly all these people would be murdered, the Western democracies did not deem it immoral to bomb German cities. There was a general sense that the German people, not just a handful of Nazis, were responsible for Nazi evil, and therefore deserved punishment. Among the first orders General Dwight D. Eisenhower, the head of the Allied war effort issued after victory over Germany, was one compelling local German populations to view the horrors committed in the concentration and death camps in their vicinity, and to provide a proper burial for the mounds of corpses piled high by the Nazis. Eisenhower obviously believed Germans as a whole were guilty. Likewise, Japanese citizens overwhelmingly supported the Nazi-like Japanese regime during the 1930s and 1940s. That regime engaged in mass murder, mass rape, mass torture, mass enslavement, and grotesque medical experiments on fully conscious human beings in subjugated Asian countries such as Korea and China. And the evidence of internal resistance to the government is small, if not nil. As with Nazi Germany, the Japanese were deemed to be collectively guilty. Specific Egyptian gods targeted by the plagues. Verse 5. "And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, when I stretch out my hand over Egypt and bring out the Israelites from their midst." As noted, the third purpose of the plagues was to demonstrate to the Israelites and to the Egyptians that God is God. Most importantly, God, not nature, is the only divinity. Therefore, the plagues were directed at the nature gods of Egypt. Here is a list of some of the Egyptian nature gods against which the plagues were directed. First plague, water turned to blood. The gods attached to the Nile River. Second plague, frogs. The frog god and goddess. Third plague, lice, the earth god. Fourth plague, flies, insects, the fly god and or the beetle god. Fifth plague, diseased cattle, gods associated with bulls and cows. Sixth plague, boils, gods of healing. Seventh plague, hail, gods of the sky, atmosphere and agriculture. Eighth plague, locusts, the gods who protected against locusts and human disease. Ninth plague, darkness, the sun god and moon god. Tenth plague, deaths of firstborn, all of Egypt's gods, including Pharaoh, and a response to the mass killing of the Hebrews' sons. One of the Torah's primary purposes in Genesis chapter 1, its opening chapter, is to disassociate God from nature, and to make it clear God is outside of nature and rules it. Here in Exodus, the plagues are all directed against the nature gods of Egypt, reinforcing Genesis chapter 1 and demonstrating the one true God who created nature rules over it. Worship of nature versus worship of God. It is thoroughly understandable that human beings would worship nature. In this world, nature, after all, is everything. But nature, unlike the God of the Torah, is amoral and therefore unworthy of worship. Whereas God is preoccupied with good and evil and with justice, nature has no interest in any of them. Nature is governed by blind forces and the amoral law of the survival of the fittest. It is, in Tennyson's famous description, red in tooth and claw. Verse 6. This Moses and Aaron did, as the Lord commanded them, so they did. Verse 7, Moses was 80 years old and Aaron 83 when they made their demand on Pharaoh. Verse 8, the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, verse 9, when Pharaoh speaks to you and says, produce your marvel, you shall say to Aaron, take your rod and cast it down before Pharaoh. It shall turn into a serpent. Verse 10. So Moses and Aaron came before Pharaoh and did just as the Lord had commanded. Aaron cast down his rod in the presence of Pharaoh and his courtiers, and it turned into a serpent. Verse 11. Then Pharaoh, for his part, summoned the wise men and the sorcerers, and the Egyptian magicians in turn did the same with their spells. God begins with a startling act, albeit one the Egyptian magicians would be able to replicate. Perhaps this was to build up Pharaoh's confidence that he had nothing to fear from Moses and his God. The tone of the Torah implies the Egyptian magicians performed real magic with their spells. But it soon becomes clear this is magic only in the modern sense of the word, illusions that fool an audience. The fact Pharaoh later pleads with Moses, and not with his own magicians, to rid Egypt of frogs, Exodus chapter 8, verse 4, suggests Pharaoh regarded or came to regard his magicians as illusionists rather than as authentic magicians. Why the Torah so opposes magic? Verse 12. Each cast down his rod, and they turned into serpents, but Aaron's rod swallowed their rods. The Torah radically opposes belief in magic, as opposed to magic tricks and illusions presented as entertainment, because magic implies forces other than God control the world. The swallowing of the Egyptian rods is therefore intended to demonstrate that a trick performed by illusionists through sleight of hand cannot stand up to a miracle of God. Hence, the Egyptian magicians cannot replicate what Aaron, acting at God's behest, does. Verse 13. Yet Pharaoh's heart stiffened, and he did not heed them, as the Lord had said. Verse 14. And the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh is stubborn. He refuses to let the people go. The plagues follow a pattern. Verse 15. Go to Pharaoh in the morning as he is coming out to the water, and station yourself before him at the edge of the Nile, taking with you the rod that turned into a snake. Pharaoh would go to the Nile every morning. Perhaps he went there to bathe, or perhaps to pray to the river god Hapi, who the Egyptians believed oversaw the annual flooding of the Nile, which deposited fertile soil on its banks. In any event, Pharaoh's apparently daily visit to the Nile plays an important role in the way the plagues unfold. The events preceding each of the first nine plagues follow a pattern. The first nine plagues are divided into three groups of three. Before the first, fourth, and seventh plagues, blood, insects, hail, Moses is instructed to go in the morning and station himself where Pharaoh will be. Before the second, fifth, and eighth plagues, frogs, pestilence, locusts, Moses is instructed to go to Pharaoh's palace and confront him there. And each of these plagues is executed by Aaron rather than Moses. The third, sixth, and ninth plagues, lice, boils, darkness, strike without any warning. This is yet another of the innumerable patterns in the Torah that seem to demonstrate a divine order in unfolding events. At the very least, great thought was put into how the plagues were executed. Nothing was random. Verse 16. And say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, sent me to you to say, let my people go that they may worship me in the wilderness. But you have paid no heed until now. Verse 17. Thus says the Lord, by this you shall know that I am the Lord. See, I shall strike the water in the Nile with the rod that is in my hand, and it will be turned into blood. The contamination of the river served to discredit Egyptian polytheism. The Egyptians deified the Nile as the god Hapi. This first plague may be considered a fitting retribution for Pharaoh's decree that all newborn Hebrew males had to be cast into the Nile. Since so much blood was shed in this river, it would now turn to blood. Israeli Bible scholar Uriel Simon has noted the first plague's powerful symbolism. There were presumably many Egyptians who denied or ignored the evil done in their name. This plague, in bringing their crime to the surface, so to speak, made such denial impossible. Verse 18. And the fish in the Nile will die. The Nile will stink so that the Egyptians will find it impossible to drink the water of the Nile. Verse 19. And the Lord said to Moses, Say to Aaron, Take your rod and hold your arm over the waters of Egypt, its rivers, its canals, its ponds, all its bodies of water, that they may turn to blood. There shall be blood throughout the land of Egypt, even in vessels of wood and stone. Verse 20. Moses and Aaron did just as the Lord commanded. He lifted up the rod and struck the water in the Nile in the sight of Pharaoh and his courtiers. Aaron could not, of course, hold out his arm over all of Egypt's bodies of water, as God commanded in the previous verse. And Aaron obviously did not assume the command was meant literally. Thus, the verse says Aaron did just as the Lord had commanded, even though he lifted his rod only over the water in the Nile, not over all the waters of Egypt. As a result, there is still some uncontaminated water left for the Egyptian magicians to turn to blood when they replicate this seeming trick. See verse 22. Verse 20 continued, And all the water in the Nile was turned into blood. Verse 21, And the fish in the Nile died. The Nile stank so that the Egyptians could not drink water from the Nile, and there was blood throughout the land of Egypt. For those seeking natural as opposed to miraculous explanations for the plagues, Sarna explains that one way of viewing the plagues is as an extreme intensification of natural phenomena. In this plague, a period of heavy rainfall caused the river to become so full of purple bacteria and eroded red sediment that it appeared blood-like. The purple bacteria that washed down into the river disturbed the oxygen balance and killed off the fish, which in turn produced a foul stench. Of course, if the Nile turned into actual blood, as the literal reading of the text suggests, that too would have killed off the fish. All these explanations notwithstanding, an extreme intensification of natural phenomena, given its perfect timing, is also a miracle. In any event, I see no need to try to explain the plagues or any miracles as natural phenomena. If they are only natural phenomena, they aren't miracles. Verse 22. But when the Egyptian magicians did the same with their spells, in those directions toward which Aaron did not stretch forth his hand, pure water remained. Moses and Aaron must have found it rather humorous, if not absurd, that the Egyptian magicians were so eager to outdo Moses and Aaron, they intensified the plague on their own country. Look, Pharaoh, we too can ruin our water supply. Verse 22 continued. Pharaoh's heart stiffened, and he did not heed them, as the Lord had spoken. This time Moses does not panic or grow angry upon hearing Pharaoh's response, since God forewarned him Pharaoh would continue to refuse to set the Israelites free. Verse 23, Pharaoh turned and went into his palace, paying no regard even to this. Verse 24, And all the Egyptians had to dig round about the Nile for drinking water, because they could not drink the water of the Nile. Verse 25. When 7 days had passed after the Lord struck the Nile, the number 7 and its multiples figure prominently throughout the Torah. See the commentary on the number 7 in Exodus chapter 6, verse 6. In this chapter, the word Nile is mentioned 14 times, twice 7. These encoded patterns happen too often to be coincidence. They are there to suggest a single author, or for those who prefer, a single editor. Verse 26, The Lord said to Moses, Go to Pharaoh and say to him, Thus says the Lord, Let my people go, that they may worship me. Verse 27, If you refuse to let them go, then I will plague your whole country with frogs. The god that this plague discredited was the frog-headed goddess Hecht, the consort of the god Khnum. Given that Hecht was thought to assist in childbirth, this plague may be considered a second instance of retribution for the killing of the Hebrew male newborns. Verse 28. The Nile shall swarm with frogs, and they shall come up and enter your palace, your bedchamber, and your bed, the houses of your courtiers and your people, and your ovens and your kneading bowls. Verse 29. The frogs shall come up on you and on your people, and on all your courtiers. Chapter 8, verse 1. And the Lord said to Moses, Say to Aaron, Hold out your arm with the rod over the rivers, the canals, and the ponds, and bring up the frogs on the land of Egypt. Verse 2. Aaron held out his arm over the waters of Egypt, and the frogs came up and covered the land of Egypt. Of all of the plagues, frogs were the least destructive. This plague, in addition to being directed against the frog god of Egypt, Hekt, may have been designed simply to annoy and humiliate Pharaoh and the Egyptians. Even Pharaoh's bed, Exodus chapter 7, verse 28, was infested with frogs. There is a song about this humiliation, commonly sung by Jewish children at the Passover Seder. One morning when Pharaoh woke in his bed, there were frogs on his head and frogs in his bed, frogs on his nose and frogs on his toes. Frogs here, frogs there, frogs were jumping everywhere. Verse 3, But the magicians did the same with their spells, and brought frogs upon the land of Egypt. As with the previous plague, water turned into blood, the Egyptians are so eager to outdo Moses and Aaron, they bring further damage upon their own land. Pharaoh must have grown outraged with his magicians. He wanted them to rid the land of the frogs, not multiply them. Verse 4. Then Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron and said, Plead with the Lord to remove the frogs from me and my people, and I will let the people go to sacrifice to the Lord. A significant change occurs here. Pharaoh directs his plea to rid the land of frogs not to his own magicians, but to Moses and his God. On some level, he must have understood his magicians relied on tricks, while what the God of Moses was doing was real. Now Pharaoh uses God's name. As previously noted, when referring to God, all English translations use Lord when the Hebrew uses God's name, YHVH. He even asks Moses to pray to YHVH on his behalf. Evidently, Pharaoh is being converted, albeit slowly and reluctantly, into a believer in God, though not into an ethical monotheist. He is not a monotheist, since he probably still believes in Egyptian gods in addition to YHVH, and he certainly doesn't believe God demands ethical behavior. Verse 5. And Moses said to Pharaoh, You may have this triumph over me. For what time shall I plead in behalf of you and your courtiers and your people, that the frogs be cut off from you and your houses to remain only in the Nile? In order to more fully convince Pharaoh of God's power, Moses lets Pharaoh select the time when he would like the frogs to be removed. Moses is acting like the magician who invites a member of his audience to pick a card, any card. Were the magician to pick a card, the trick would impress no one. Verse 6. For tomorrow, he replied. And Moses said, As you say, that you may know that there is none like the Lord our God. This phrase, that you may know that there is none like the Lord our God, appears four times during the plague stories, another deliberate pattern. It recurs with such frequency because the purpose of the plagues is, in large part, to reveal the one true God to humanity. This is the primary purpose of the Torah and of the Jewish people, and making God known has been the most important contribution to humanity ever made. Here are 15 reasons why this contribution has been so significant. Many of them are discussed at greater length at different points throughout this commentary. Essay: The God of the Torah, the most important idea in world history. 1. The God introduced by the Torah is the first God in history to have been entirely above and beyond nature. And one of the first things God tells humans is to exercise dominion over nature. Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 through 28. This liberated humanity from believing it was controlled by nature, a revolution that made moral and scientific progress possible. A second consequence of God being above nature is humans are not part of nature, meaning that just as we are to control the natural world outside us, we are to control our own human nature within us as well. We are to govern our lives by moral law, not by human nature. 2. The God introduced by the Torah brought universal morality into the world. Only if a moral God is universal, is morality universal. Morality was no longer local or individual. Cultures do not need to be universal. The world is enriched by multiple cultures, but morality must be universal. 3. The moral God introduced by the Torah means morality is real. Good and evil are not merely individual or societal opinions, but objectively real. 4. The God introduced by the Torah morally judges every human being. There had never been a concept like this, and it became a major reason for Jew hatred. People do not like to be judged, and the people who introduced the idea of a God who morally judges people have paid a terrible price for bringing the idea into the world. The social psychologist Ernest Vandenhag wrote, "Fundamental to anti-Semitism, though seldom explicit and conscious, is hostility to the Jewish belief in one God. The Jews' invisible God not only insisted on being the one and only and all-powerful God, creator and lord of everything, and the only rightful claimant to worship, he also developed into a moral God. No wonder the Jews are the target of all those who resent his domination." Having dialogued with atheists for decades, I have come to believe at least some of the current aggressive atheism is due to an animosity toward the idea there is a God who will judge all of us. Another reason is all the evil done in the name of God by radical Islamists. The worst sin according to the Ten Commandments. See Commandment 3 in Exodus chapter 20. 5. The just and good God introduced by the Torah gives humanity hope. One of those hopes is there is ultimate justice. The belief that God judges humans means both the good and the evil will get what they ultimately deserve. Even though justice is rarely served in this world, there is a good God who will ultimately set things right. 6. The God introduced by the Torah introduced holiness, the elevation of human beings from animals to creatures created in the divine image. See commentary to Leviticus chapter 19, verse 2. 7. The God introduced by the Torah gives every individual unprecedented self-worth. Since all humans are created in God's image, each of us is infinitely valuable. Every person has the right to say, as the Talmud put it, "For my sake was the world created." The 19th century Hasidic master Rabbi Simcha Bunim suggested that every person carry in his or her pockets two pieces of paper. On one should be written, "For my sake was the world created," while the other should contain the words, "I am but dust and ashes," the words Abraham said when he argued with God in Genesis chapter 18, verse 27. Each paper should be consulted at the appropriate time. When you feel arrogant and proud of how much more you have achieved than others, remind yourself you are but dust and ashes. And when you are feeling despair, remind yourself, "For my sake was the world created." There is some special mission and task only you can accomplish. 8. The God introduced by the Torah is necessary for human brotherhood. Since we all have the same father, we are all brothers and sisters. As the prophet Malachi asked, "Have we not all one father? Did not one God create us?" Malachi chapter 2, verse 10. 9. The God introduced by the Torah began the long journey to belief in human equality, solely as a result of the Torah's statement that each of us is created in God's image. Slavery was abolished on a wide scale first in the Western world, by Christians who were rooted in the Torah and the rest of the Hebrew Bible, and who specifically cited the Torah doctrine that all humans are created in God's image. 10. The God introduced by the Torah is incorporeal, no body, not physical. This opened the human mind to abstract thought by enabling humans to think in terms of a reality beyond that which is accessible to our senses. 11. The God introduced by the Torah teaches us the physical is not the only reality. Consequently, there can be non-physical realities, such as a soul, an afterlife, and morality. 12. The God introduced by the Torah means there is ultimate meaning to existence and to each of our lives. Without this creator, existence is random and purposeless. That people make up meanings for their lives is a fine thing, at least when that meaning is moral. Many things, evil ideologies are the most obvious example, that give people meaning are not moral. But these meanings are nothing more than artificial constructs. As one atheist professor expressed it in summarizing the work of another atheist philosopher, ultimately, our lives are meaningless. Evolution is blind and serves no intrinsic purpose. In a cosmic sense, we each live for an insignificant amount of time. David Benatar, a professor of philosophy at the University of Cape Town, argues that humans can enjoy terrestrial meanings, nurturing children, fighting for the rights of refugees, composing a symphony, or making a delicious breakfast, for example. Nevertheless, we are each but a blip in cosmic time and space. Mr. Benatar insists that most of us are terminally anxious about this lack of cosmic meaning. I did a very unscientific poll of my friends. None of them believe that there is some wider purpose to human existence. 13. The God introduced by the Torah gives human beings free will. If we are only material beings, like the stellar dust of which we are composed, everything we do is determined by our genes and by our environment. Only if we have a non-material soul can we rise above our genes and our environment and act autonomously. The secular denial of anything beyond the physical deprives human beings of free will. That is why Clarence Darrow, the most famous criminal defense lawyer in American history, as well as America's most famous religious skeptic, opposed all punishment of criminals. All people are products of two things and two things only, their heredity and environment. And they act in exact accord with the heredity which they took from all the past and for which they are in no wise responsible, and the environment. 14. The God introduced by the Torah teaches might is not right. It is God who determines what is right, not displays of strength and force. 15. Finally, the God introduced by the Torah made human moral progress possible. Indeed, the Torah invented human moral progress. In the words of New York University historian Henry Bamford Parks, Judaism, starting with the Torah, repudiated the cyclic view of history held by all other ancient peoples and affirmed that it was a meaningful process leading to the gradual regeneration of humanity. This was the origin of the Western belief in progress. What was the cyclic view of history referred to by Professor Parks? In ancient civilizations, life was a cycle, meaning nothing changed from generation to generation. Every generation essentially repeated what came before it. There was therefore no such thing as moral progress. Indeed, the word progress would have been meaningless. Then came the Torah and its God, and life was no longer to be a cycle, but a line. A line moving forward toward a moral goal. Verse 7. The frogs shall retreat from you and your courtiers and your people. They shall remain only in the Nile. Verse 8, then Moses and Aaron left Pharaoh's presence, and Moses cried out to the Lord in the matter of the frogs which he had inflicted upon Pharaoh. Moses does not just speak to God or pray to him. He cries out. Furthermore, he does so immediately upon leaving Pharaoh. Moses' response seems to imply he is anxious to relieve the suffering of the innocent Egyptians who were plagued by the frogs. Just as Abraham pleaded for those in Sodom who might be innocent, Genesis chapter 18, verses 23 through 32, Moses pleads for those Egyptians he believes are not full-fledged evildoers. If this is an accurate read of the words cried out, Moses was an almost perfect embodiment of justice and compassion. The man who killed an Egyptian taskmaster is now crying out for innocent Egyptians. In both cases, justice and compassion determined Moses' actions. In the first, justice demanded the taskmaster stop beating the slave, an innocent man, and compassion for the slave demanded the beating stop. In the second case, justice demanded Pharaoh be forced to release the Israelites, and compassion for the Israelites demanded the same thing. Why Moses did not similarly cry out before and after later plagues, especially the 10th, the killing of the firstborn, is a question worth posing. We can only surmise that, for whatever reason, by the time of the last plague, Moses fully trusted in God and his judgments. Verse 9. And the Lord did as Moses asked. The frogs died out in the houses, the courtyards, and the fields. Moses was not instructed by God to let Pharaoh predict the time when the frogs should be removed. Moses determined the time, apparently confident God would act on his request. Verse 10, and they piled them up in heaps till the land stank. Verse 11, but when Pharaoh saw that there was relief, he became stubborn and would not heed them, as the Lord had spoken. God told Moses Pharaoh would stubbornly refuse to set the Israelites free, and amazingly, given the plague he just experienced, and while he could still smell the stench from the piles of decaying frogs, Pharaoh indeed refused. Verse 12. Then the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, hold out your rod and strike the dust of the earth, and it shall turn to lice throughout the land of Egypt. Verse 13. And they did so. Aaron held out his arm with the rod and struck the dust of the earth, and vermin came upon man and beast. All the dust of the earth turned to lice throughout the land of Egypt. Verse 14. The magicians did the like with their spells to produce lice, but they could not. The vermin remained upon man and beast. This plague represents an escalation in intensity, because unlike the blood and frogs, Pharaoh's magicians are unable to bring about the lice. The magician's failed attempt demonstrates a key theme of the Torah and of the plagues. God alone controls the universe. Verse 15. And the magicians said to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. The magicians do not use God's proper name, YHVH, because they are not acknowledging the God of the Israelites caused the plague. They are simply informing Pharaoh that some divine power is responsible. Verse 15 continued, but Pharaoh's heart stiffened, and he would not heed them as the Lord had spoken. The Torah here does not state that God made Pharaoh's heart strong, but rather that Pharaoh does so himself. Only with the later plagues does the Torah claim God is directly responsible. This shift in language seems to signify that if Pharaoh really wanted to change his mind after one of the early plagues, God would have allowed him to. But by the time the later plagues strike, and Pharaoh has already refused to free the Israelites several times, he loses his chance. Verse 16. And the Lord said to Moses, early in the morning present yourself to Pharaoh as he is coming out to the water, and say to him, thus says the Lord, let my people go, that they may worship me. The purpose of the liberation from Egypt is not only liberation, but the service of God, living according to his rules and spreading ethical monotheism to the world's nations. Verse 17, for if you do not let my people go, I will let loose swarms of insects against you. In the Hebrew, this verse contains a play on the word send. A literal translation would read, if you don't send my people, I will send a swarm of insects. God is telling Pharaoh something will be sent. Either Pharaoh will send the Israelites, or God will send another plague. Verse 17 continued, and your courtiers and your people and your houses, the houses of the Egyptians, and the very ground they stand on shall be filled with swarms of insects. Verse 18, but on that day I will set apart the region of Goshen, where my people dwell, so that no swarms of insects shall be there. God adds another miraculous element to the impression he is making upon Pharaoh. He ensures the Israelites alone are not affected by the plague. Verse 18 continued, that you may know that I, the Lord, am in the midst of the land. Sarna comments that, for the first time, a clear distinction is made between the Egyptians and the Israelites, and the time of the onset of the plague is fixed, Both particulars leaving no doubt the source of the plague is not just any God, but YHWH, God of Israel. God therefore wants Pharaoh to realize he is God everywhere, not just in the wilderness where the Israelites have been seeking permission to go worship him. Verse 19, "And I will make a distinction between my people and your people. Tomorrow this sign shall come to pass." Verse 20, "And the Lord did so." Heavy swarms of insects invaded Pharaoh's palace and the houses of his courtiers. Throughout the country of Egypt, the land was ruined because of the swarms of insects. Verse 21, "Then Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron and said," this time, Moses and Aaron do not come before Pharaoh on their own initiative. They wait for him to call them. Verse 21 continued, "Go and sacrifice to your Lord within the land." Now Pharaoh concedes even less than he did before. Whereas he earlier granted the Israelites permission to leave Egypt for a brief period, a permission he later revoked, he now tells them they can worship their God, but only while remaining in Egypt. Verse 22. "But Moses replied, it would not be right to do this, for what we sacrifice to the Lord our God is untouchable to the Egyptians. If we sacrifice that which is untouchable to the Egyptians before their very eyes, will they not stone us?" Moses provides a brilliant refutation of Pharaoh's offer of a week-long vacation to worship in Egypt. He tells Pharaoh the animals the Israelites wish to slaughter are worshipped in the Egyptian religion. Therefore, performing their sacrifices in the presence of the Egyptians might cause pandemonium and incite violence from the Egyptians. Moses seems to be speaking considerately to Pharaoh, but he is effectively deriding Pharaoh's religion by stating the Israelites need to slaughter and sacrifice Egyptian gods in order to serve their God. Moses has clearly become a shrewd negotiator. Verse 23. "So we must go a distance of 3 days into the wilderness and sacrifice to the Lord our God as he may command us." Verse 24. Pharaoh said, "I will let you go to sacrifice to the Lord your God in the wilderness, but do not go very far. Plead then for me." Verse 25. "And Moses said, when I leave your presence, I will plead with the Lord that the swarms of insects depart tomorrow from Pharaoh and his courtiers and his people. Let not Pharaoh again act deceitfully, not letting the people go to sacrifice to the Lord." Instead of leaving immediately to go plead with God, as he did the last time Pharaoh made this request, Moses first takes the time to rebuke Pharaoh for playing games with the Israelites. Moses increasingly feels free to speak to Pharaoh from a position of superiority. Verse 26. "So Moses left Pharaoh's presence and pleaded with the Lord." Whereas Moses cried out to God during the plague of the frogs because he was concerned about the welfare of innocent Egyptians, Moses now merely pleads with God to fulfill his assurance to Pharaoh that he would do so. He is likely and understandably losing patience. Verse 27, "And the Lord did as Moses asked. He removed the swarms of insects from Pharaoh, from his courtiers, and from his people. Not one remained." Verse 28, "But Pharaoh became stubborn this time also, and would not let the people go." As with the other early plagues, it is Pharaoh who steals his own heart once the insects have been removed. Everett Fox, who has made the most literal English language translation of the Torah, translates this verse, "But Pharaoh made his heart heavy with stubbornness this time as well, and he did not send the people free." There is a lesson here for any of us who have stubbornly clung to a cause that is not only wrong, but is failing. The Japanese leaders knew they were losing World War II, but the stubbornness of their military leaders brought down upon them the atom bomb, as the stubbornness of Pharaoh soon brought down upon his people the death of their firstborn. The Egyptian people might have thought their enemy was the God of Israel, but just as the real enemies of the Japanese people were their own leaders, the real enemy of the Egyptian people was Pharaoh. Chapter 9, verse 1. "The Lord said to Moses, go to Pharaoh and say to him, thus says the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, let my people go to worship me. Verse 2. For if you refuse to let them go and continue to hold them, verse 3, then the hand of the Lord will strike your livestock in the fields, the horses,